Tēnā koutou, nō mai, haere mai. Welcome to Q&A. I'm Jack Tame. This morning, the government's big plans to make it cheaper to build a house.
We have a major challenge. Our building costs have gone up 41% in just the last 5 years across New Zealand. To build a house here in New Zealand is now 50% more expensive than it is in Australia.
And then hate speech laws might have been cancelled, but hate crime laws are still on the table.
What does hate crime mean? Defacing a rainbow crossing? Defacing te tiriti at te papa?
We will have that interview for you shortly. But first this morning, the new government is pushing ahead with plans to reform health and safety laws. Workplace deaths and injuries are estimated to cost New Zealand more than $4 billion a year. But the minister responsible says the compliance burden for some employers is excessive. Brooke Van Velden is the government's new Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety. Good morning, congratulations on your appointment.
Good morning.
Let's start off with some basics then. Since you're new to the gig, what are your priorities?
Well, my priorities are to make sure that we are simplifying and we are clarifying the laws for businesses so that we can build back business confidence. Over the last few years, businesses have told us that they've been really hurting. They've got added costs, added pressures, and we want an economy that thrives because we know if we can get it working for business, we can get it working for workers, and that's good for everybody. So firstly, starting off with the Holidays Act, it's far too complex. Talk to anybody, talk to a worker, talk to businesses. They say we're spending far too much time on compliance, really worried they're getting it wrong and people aren't getting the right entitlements. So let's simplify that law and make it easier so people can actually do their core role in their business.
Yeah.
We're looking then at health and safety law reform, because I talk to people all the time. They say, I don't actually know how I'm supposed to comply. I feel like I'm in some sort of grey zone. And we're spending time and money putting up all of these posters to try and show that we're keeping our workers safe and we're trying to do the right thing, but we're really not sure if we are. So I want to clarify those laws and make it simpler for businesses and for workers in the organisations to know what they need to do to keep themselves and their colleagues safe. And then we'll look at considering some changes to the Employment Relations Act, you know, hearing from businesses again saying it's really hard with so many personal grievance claims coming through, and also not really knowing how they're supposed to be following the law and what the law is when it comes to contracting arrangements versus employment agreements. And then finally, looking at how we have effective use of services, things like WorkSafe and the Labour Dispute Resolution Services, making sure that they're actually fit for purpose and working for workers.
I want to ask a bit more about WorkSafe in a couple of minutes. Let's take a look at that health and safety part of the equation as you see it. Workplace deaths in New Zealand at the moment are twice those of those in Australia, four times the number across the population in the UK. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's a very good question, and this is why I want to look at it. You know, I don't think it's right that we still have people dying at work. My focus when we're looking at health and safety reform is how do we make sure that we're looking after workers? And we're not just putting more and more costs and compliance on businesses that see their costs go up, but we're actually seeing outcomes and better results.
So at the moment, though, why do you think it is? What's your sense of things? I know you're new to the portfolio, but do you have a sense as to why the number of workplace deaths in New Zealand are so high relative to other countries?
Well, I think it's a range of factors. Firstly, we have taken on new health and safety reform. That was 10 years ago. This is why we're looking at all the evidence now. But I think it's an unclear law. People don't know how they are supposed to be complying. You know, I talked to, for example, someone who works in construction. They said, we're not actually sure whether these business briefing things that we have every morning are actually keeping people safe, whether people are actually listening to what their obligations are.
Yeah.
But there's also, in some ways, a little bit of uncertainty of how much workers within the workplace are needing to keep themselves safe and follow the laws, rather than just looking at what the PCBU on the worksite might need to do to keep themselves safe. So in my opinion, it's not okay. You know, we clearly need to look at this because people are not coming home at the end of the day and we need to change that. But we can't then look at, okay, if we could change the law, how do we put more costs and more regulations on it without actually thinking, will it actually have a better effect at the end of the day?
Let's talk about WorkSafe. The agency has cut scores of jobs. It's been running a deficit. The previous chief executive resigned. This week, the acting chief executive resigned. What's going on?
Well, it's not actually a surprise to me that the acting chief executive has resigned. His role was to be more of a change agent. There have been concerns with WorkSafe for some time. He was brought in to refocus the organisation. There was a Sage Bush review a few years back now that showed people really unsure how that regulator was actually functioning. There were some serious concerns. He was to refocus and streamline that organisation, which he has done. Now we're coming up to a new financial year. It kind of feels like it's the right time to get somebody in who would be able to be there for a little bit longer and put in place some of those changes. One area that we knew was of concern was WorkSafe's finances. They had found themselves in a lack of money, but of course they are levy-based. So for myself as a government, I look at it and think, okay, we are expecting taxpayers to want effective results for the money that we're spending, right? Levy payers should expect the same. So if people are putting money in to work health and safety, they should at least know that it's going to a better outcome.
OK. I know you're going through a consultation process at the moment, but given you're a few months into the portfolio now, I want to get a sense of direction from you when it comes to the changes in the areas where the most New Zealand workers die on the job. So if you look at machinery and equipment and working at heights, which is like includes things like scaffolding, together they account for about 80% of New Zealand workplace-related deaths. So what changes do you think you might be in a position to make that would reduce that number in those spaces?
Well, look, I don't want to preempt what the changes would be. I think what's really important is that we acknowledge it's not OK. The number of deaths that we have in forestry and construction is not OK. I want to do a proper consultation, looking right back, stripping back the laws and the regulations and saying to every business person that we can get our hands on and workers as well, what do you actually think the role of health and safety in your workplace is? How is it working at the moment? What would you want to change? And so we'll be going for a very fulsome consultation period.
Will your consultation include ways to reduce the number of workers who die from workplace-related diseases in New Zealand?
I would expect so. It's very, very wide and encompassing, all aspects of health and safety law.
15 times higher. That's stunning, right? Like the worker is 15 times more likely to die from a workplace-related disease than in an accident. Obviously, so much of the focus for health and safety in particular goes on the accidents.
Absolutely. And I think that is an issue that we do need to look at. You're right, there are people who might not come home at the end of the day. That's absolutely tragic. There are people who might finish their work and in a few years develop a disease which has life-limiting conditions for them. We need to look at all of this.
Yeah.
This is why this reform is not something that I'm hoping to have done by the end of the year. It's going to be very comprehensive because if we're changing the laws, we have to get them right and they have to be outcomes focused.
How important are workplace safety inspectors in lowering the number of deaths and injuries in the workplace?
Well, that is one of the questions that I know has been revolving around WorkSafe for a couple of years, which is why we have had some change within WorkSafe and why I'm focusing on WorkSafe to set performance metrics. I've spoken to companies who have said, look, my business has been targeted three or four times by WorkSafe for audits, but I know my mate down the road, he's never had an auditor come in. So that's something that we need to look at. Why is WorkSafe targeting specific businesses versus others? And does that actually lead to better outcomes?
But I'm talking about workplace safety inspectors. So how important are those inspectors in reducing the number of workplace deaths and injuries in New Zealand?
Well, I think inspectors are very important because you look at it two ways. You need the businesses to be able to follow the law, comply with the law, but of course there's always a bit of carrot and a little bit of stick. If people know that there's the possibility for a labour inspectorate agent to come into their place or the WorkSafe agents to come into their place and inspect whether they are complying with the law, you've got both the carrot for compliance and the stick.
So is your sense at the moment that we have enough stick?
I think there is a little bit of, like I said before, uncertainty on what that stick actually is. You know, WorkSafe hasn't been doing its adequate role. The Sage Bush review was very clear that they didn't actually know, businesses up and down New Zealand didn't know why WorkSafe existed and what they were there to do.
Well, let's look at the number of WorkSafe safety inspectors. So do you know what WorkSafe's target is for per 100,000 workers? Do you know roughly what their target is for the number of WorkSafe's workplace safety inspectors?
Not off the top
of my head. That's right, it's 10, right? So that was their target. So for every 100,000 workers now, do you know how many inspectors New Zealand has?
Not off the top of my head.
6.3. So the target is 10 per 100,000, At the moment, we have 6.3, which has dropped from 8.4 per 100,000 a decade ago. Do you think increasing the number of health and safety inspectors relative to the number of workers and workplaces would improve workplace health and safety?
I think it's a very good question, but it does come back to what has WorkSafe been doing? You know, if you look over the last few years, the number of people employed at WorkSafe has really gone up. It's really, really gone
up. But we're talking about those frontline inspectors. No, that's right.
Exactly. So what we have tried to do as an organisation is streamline and refocus the efforts. Why is it that backroom functions have really, really increased? The outcomes are still
poor. So that doesn't entirely answer my question, though. So would increasing the number of workplace health and safety inspectors relative to the number of workers and workplaces improve health and safety?
I think it's a very good question.
I know you've said but that's what you said before. So what's the answer to the question?
No, but I think it does actually come back to our health and safety reform. If businesses are unsure whether or not they are able to comply with the law or whether they know what their obligations are, is the role of the inspector actually useful? You've got to
You're suggesting
sure
that the role of inspectors isn't useful?
It is useful if people know what the law is that they're following.
Yeah, but you can do both of these things at the same time.
No, that's not true. I've talked to businesses who have said when the inspector comes in, the inspector's sometimes not sure whether the business is complying because the law sometimes has these grey zones.
But by way of example again, Australia currently has 11 inspectors for every 100,000 workers. We have 6.4. Australia has almost twice as many inspectors as us, but we have twice as many deaths. You're suggesting that those things aren't related?
Well, I'm saying this is why we're looking into health and safety reform. You can get into the weeds of all the numbers if you'd like to.
That just seems like a vital thing, especially for those industries where there are the highest numbers of deaths. Actually having frontline inspectors come and make sure that businesses are doing what they are required to do in order to keep their workers safe. Seems
like a pretty obvious place to focus.
But
like I said before, only if the inspectors are actually turning up to the businesses that are of interest to them. So why is it that when I've got people saying I've had WorkSafe investigators coming to my shop three or four times, I've always been in compliance with the law, but I know some other mates of mine might be a little bit different and they've never had an inspector. How are they actually making those determinations? Because we're only going to see better outcomes if we're actually asking the right questions. Mm. Is it appropriate if we get 1,000 more investigators but they still just turn up to the exact same shops? That's not going to actually lead to any better outcomes.
I will quote to you from your briefing as an incoming minister, quote, organisations inspected by WorkSafe have lower rates of serious ACC claims compared to non-inspected organisations. Our inspectors do valuable work that prevents work injuries and deaths. Again, 6.4 per 100,000 compared to Australia, which has 11 inspectors per 100,000. Australia has banned engineered stone in construction after a surge of cases of silicosis, which is that awful condition affecting the lungs. Will New Zealand follow suit? I know you've been taking advice on this.
You're absolutely right. I have been taking advice. It has literally just dropped on my desk this weekend, so I haven't had the chance to go through all of it. But what I would say to this is the evidence is quite new, and it is developing all the time. So I think it's right that we take the time to actually make sure that we get it right, that we're analysing all of the issues, all of our options, but not necessarily just going straight.
Is it right to take time? If this is risking the lives of New Zealanders who are working with these products, wouldn't a more judicious approach be to actually put a pause on it, like Australia is doing, and then wait for more evidence to build before making a long-term decision?
Well, I'm not necessarily sure being reactionary in that regard is correct. I'd take the note that Australia is the only country in the world that has gone with that measure. Other countries may pick a variety of options.
And Safe Work in Australia says this, quote, there is no toxicological evidence of a safe threshold of crystalline silica content.
And that's why we're looking at the evidence.
But my question is, if you were acting in the interests of workers, wouldn't a more judicious approach be to put a pause on it, like Australia's doing, while you wait for that evidence to come in so you can take the time to make a longer-term decision?
No, I think it's actually better for us to make sure that we are analysing all of the evidence, all of the advice, and actually reaching the right option.
Would it keep workers safer?
It may not be that the ban is the correct approach, but we don't know that yet.
No, which is why I'm suggesting that we follow that an option could be to follow Australia. Do you think putting a pause on that and then considering the future of it once more evidence comes in would give greater surety around worker safety in the short term?
What I think I want to be very clear on is I don't want to be a reactionary politician where any red flag or any signal means that we stop the economy. I don't think that's good for people. I don't think it's good for businesses. I don't actually think it's good for workers as well. We need people to be able to turn up to work. We need them to be healthy. We need them to be safe.
We need them to be alive, don't we?
Of course. Absolutely. But we can't just stop everything every time we hear that there might be a potential red flag. Absolutely, we have to look at the evidence. It's a very developing situation, but we're only just receiving it. So I can't comment further on what we will do, but I want the time to actually get it right.
How long do you think that process will take, just roughly? Any idea?
You're going to have to give me the time, Jack.
No. Just is it likely to be weeks or months or any sense of things?
I'll be working through it. Like I said, it's just arrived on my desk. I don't know what the options and the advice that's been presented to me. But I think I just want to bring this back high level. We do want workers to be safe. We do want... That's at the heart of the health and safety reform that this government will be doing.
Well, it's not actually, because, I mean, you've said time and time again that actually reducing the compliance burden is the thing that you're focusing on. I appreciate that it's a balance, right? I think we can all see that. But that is your priority.
Well, they both can work together.
Yeah.
You can have lowered compliance where you have costs that aren't actually coming to have better outcomes. Mm. But also the focus of health and safety is of course, on keeping workers healthy and safe at work, because that works in the interests of both people. You know, if businesses have unhealthy staff, they're less productive staff, so everybody wants them to be healthy.
You're extending 90-day trials. You said it makes it more likely a firm will take a punt on hiring a worker. What evidence do you have that the 90-day trial periods increase firms' overall hiring?
Well, it's part of building back business confidence. We heard that businesses want this government to be a government of action and to back them.
And so what evidence do you have that they
The evidence that I had did come through MBIE. The only perceived threat of the policy was a perception of people that it would make their work arrangements more precarious.
My question was what evidence do you have that it works?
Well, I know from talking to people up and down New Zealand, you know, just this week I had someone phone me up and he said, yeah, my business can't wait to use these.
So just anecdotal evidence?
Anecdotal evidence, but also we have a very, very strong consultation period through the election where so many businesses said, this is what we want.
But that's anecdotal. So last time it was in effect, of course, Treasury commissioned a study on the policy. Did you read that?
I did, but this has been since December that we've made this policy.
Yeah, right. But Treasury commissioned a study on the policy when it was last in place under the previous national government. Mm-hmm. Treasury said, quote, "We find no evidence that the ability to use trial periods significantly increases firms' overall hiring. We estimate the policy effect to be as statistically and economically insignificant." What did the study miss?
Well, I think it missed the fact that businesses want us to build back their confidence.
But this is an evidence-based study. They've actually looked at the numbers as opposed to just getting vibes from businesses.
Yeah, but what I'd say, if you look at those numbers, is yes, a lot of people do use 90-day trials, but it doesn't mean that they actually fire people, you know? This gives them the confidence to take on somebody.
If you look at the, we find no evidence that the ability to use trial periods significantly increases firms' overall hiring. That as a bottom line suggests that the policy doesn't do what you say it will.
Well, I think it will. I think it will have evidence to
show. This is from a study commissioned by Treasury from when it was last in place.
Well, if you look at what this government wants to do, we want to build back business confidence. Mm. Businesses told us before the election that there were a few policies that they wanted us to work on, getting rid of the fair pay agreements, making sure that we were reinstating 90-day trials for all businesses, and also making sure that we are changing those very small compliance issues that businesses face every day, things like the Holidays Act, which we are also doing to make sure that any business and worker knows what their obligations and rights are getting paid in accordance with the law. When it comes to 90-day trials, they already existed under Labor with small businesses. If it was right for the small businesses, I see no need why big businesses were carved out of it. If it worked for them, it works for everyone.
One last question in the portfolio regarding the minimum wage. Even though I note that you have argued a higher minimum wage stops businesses from employing people, do you accept that the previous government's increases to the minimum wage coincided with historically low unemployment?
What I have seen is businesses have a lot of costs being forced onto them by the government.
Do you accept that point, though?
I would have to look at specifically why you're taking these two together.
Well, no, I mean, when you introduce changes to the minimum wage You said that having a higher minimum... you said that under the previous government, basically the minimum wage increased to a point that was unsustainable and much more... It increased much more relative to other comparable times in history. And you said that the having a high minimum wage effectively means that employers aren't enticed to bring on new employees. But I'm asking if you accept that even though the minimum wage increased quite significantly under the previous government, it coincided with historically low unemployment.
Actually, I don't think you can just take those two together and mash them up and say that they've had a complete effect on each other. Yes, there have been historically high levels of minimum wage.
And historically low levels of unemployment.
Yes, 50% increase over 7 years versus CPI going up around 25%.
What happened to unemployment in
that time? But unemployment, I mean, there's so many variables. You had locked borders under COVID, which was stopping migration into our country. You also had... so many other effects happening where you had people going off onto social welfare and not actually being added to the employment statistics, for example. So when people go out of work and onto social welfare, they're not actually in the job market. So those can actually have effects on what the employment statistic looks like. It's not the case that you can just take both and add them together and say that they've had an effect on each other. There's so many variables in our labour market.
After the break, the Department of Internal Affairs says our digital content laws are woefully out of date. So will the government support moves to regulate social media? In the 2022 to 2023 year, there were almost 40,000 child sexual exploitation reports concerning children or offenders potentially located in New Zealand. That's according to the American agency which collects the data and represents an 800% increase from 3 years ago, although much of that may be due to reporting mechanisms. The Minister for Internal Affairs is Brooke Van Velden. Is there scope for legislative change that would improve child protections in this space?
Well, I don't necessarily think there are legislative changes that are needed to be made. I'm always on the lookout for improvements that could be made because child exploitation material is abhorrent. And I want to make it very clear, anybody who has it is actually breaking the law. Yeah. It is illegal to hold, possess and to pass on child exploitation material. My understanding of why the numbers have grown so rapidly over the last few years is actually organisations around the world reporting into DIA to let them know of child exploitative material, which is a good thing because that allows DIA to look at those website URLs and to make a determination on whether it's objectionable material and take it down because it shouldn't be online. It is illegal and it must be removed.
The department's been consulting on a proposal to better regulate social media platforms. What do you think?
This is an area that's not a top priority for me. There is, I think, quite a lot of scope when it comes to social media regulation. If you look at our current laws, child exploitative material, for example, is illegal.
Of course.
And it should be taken down. Same for things like extremist content. That's also illegal and should be removed through DIA. Where it comes to children and what they're seeing online and how much time they're spending online, I think that's, in some ways, one of the reasons why the government has actually progressed with banning cell phones in schools. We're allowing kids the ability to have a few hours per day where they are talking to their peers, talking to their teachers and learning how to interact in a world without their cell phones. What happens when they come home is really parental responsibility. And I would hope that kids have the ability to talk with their parents about what they are seeing online and what is appropriate.
If you look at the EU and Australia, social media companies can be sanctioned for breaking rules and fined for breaking rules there. Something like that isn't what you're considering.
That's not something that's on the cards for me at this moment. I haven't considered what other countries have been doing in this space. But of course, we do need to have an environment where people acknowledge everyone lives on social media now. How do we keep people safe? I do still think that there are ways to keep people safe that don't need legislative change. If you look at the digital exploitation filter, for example, there are a range of ISP providers within New Zealand who have voluntarily taken up safe measures to make sure that they are filtering bad content online.
The government is promising a tax on offshore online gambling providers. Does that mean you will restrict online gambling services to licensed providers?
Well, this is an area that I'm still considering my options. You'll be aware Cabinet decided to go ahead with regulating online gambling. That could be quite wide-ranging in scope. So I'm commissioning advice from DIA, as well as my advice from my internal team, on what our range of options are.
You made a very interesting comment at the recent Health Tech Week. Quote, "When it came to COVID, we completely blew out what the value of a life was. Completely. I've never seen such a high value on life." Give us more context. What did you mean by that line?
I'd be very happy to give you more context because I've also seen this going around. This was a medical technology conference, I think last year, where someone in the audience had quite bluntly asked me, "What do you see as the value of life?" And I said, "Well, there are a range of different ways you could value it based on which government agency that you're talking to."
You're talking about for the example, value of a statistical life, right?
That's exactly right. So, for example, ACC puts a value on your life. The Transport Authority also puts value on your life. And when it came to COVID, the government made active decisions on how much money they would spend to save each life from COVID. I think these are really valid questions that we have to ask. You know, at the time, the government was spending up large to save people from COVID, which I think was right, but at the same time were making an active decision to not value the lives of women who were forced not to have breast cancer screening. And so there are women out there who now will have breast cancer when it could have been prevented because the government made an active decision that that didn't matter as much as COVID. So, yes, thank you for giving me the context there. It was about statistical life.
OK, can I ask, do you see that argument as being a binary one? By going to extreme measures, in your view, in order to preserve lives in the short term, we suffered in other areas, right? The economy suffered, education suffered, like you say, people missed important screenings. But do you accept the flip side of that, that putting a lower value on life might have benefited our economy, but more New Zealanders would have died in the short term from COVID-related illness?
Well, those are the questions that the COVID inquiry should be looking at.
But that's my question for you. If that's essentially the flip side of your argument. So do you accept that? But that by putting too much value on life in the short term, actually, if we'd lowered that value a little bit, yes, potentially more people would have died from COVID-related illness in the short term, but other measures in our economy and our society would have done better.
It's possible that there may have been a few more people. It's really, really hard to say because we only have one example, right?
It's the flip side of your argument,
though,
right?
Pandemic. Yeah. But it is a very valid question to ask for those women who missed out on breast cancer screening, who then had illnesses that have now cost far more for them in terms of their life, their health, their family, and their social well-being. Is it okay for us to have made that trade-off? As a government, these are the questions that we have to make every single day with scarce resources. These are very adult conversations, and I can understand they are discomforting to people, but that is the reality of government. And so I think with the COVID inquiry, the scope of it has been too narrow. We've looked at a lot of what the government's response was, but not enough on those wider social contexts. And even when it came to, for example, private businesses and what they were able to do, that's not really where that original terms of reference went.
End-of-life choice is coming up for review at the end of this year. As someone who worked a huge amount on that campaign when it was first introduced, how do you think the law is working, and are there priority areas where you think it can be improved and changed?
I actually think from what I've heard, it's really working very, very well. Even in the last 2 weeks, I've had two people come up to me and thank me because their family members have used it. One example was somebody's uncle who'd been suffering from a terrible terminal illness, and it actually gave the whole family comfort and that person comfort of picking their own time of their death in the way that they felt like they had control on those last few days. And a lovely woman came up to me after a conference and said that her colleague was actually planning on using it just that weekend. Really hard for everybody to have any loss in their lives. I want to acknowledge that. But of course, we have provided a bit more choice and control for people.
How could it be improved or changed, do you think?
Well, I think that will come up for the review.
Do you have views?
I haven't been following as much since the law has actually been passed, how it has been working in effect. That's now the role of Shane Retty as the Minister of Health. My role
Seems
has
surprising that you wouldn't be interested in the amount of campaigning you did for it.
I am interested in it, but it's not my function in government. That is now the Minister of Health. I take an active interest in it.
Yeah, right.
But for the statistics, for example, for this year, they'll be coming out in June.
Yeah.
So I keep up to date in the same way every member of the public does.
Are you still the only MP with an economics degree? Or is there another one? I haven't gone through the qualifications of every single new MP. Is there anyone else who's got an economics degree?
I'm not sure cross Parliament, but I know that with an Act, we've managed to bring in Andrew Hoggart, and he has an economics degree as well. So we are doubling the efforts with an Act.
OK, with that in mind, with your economics qualifications in mind, are income tax right now, are income tax cuts right now in the best interests of lowering inflation?
I think they are. I think they are for all of those New Zealanders who have really, really, really been struggling. If you look at this from a wider context, we know that businesses have suffered. There's been high inflation, absolutely. But if you think of every New Zealander when they're going out of their house for work every day, they are finding it harder and harder to actually make ends meet.
So how does giving them more money lower inflation?
So giving them a little bit more money in their own back pockets makes it easier to keep up with that rising cost of living.
Yes, but my question is, how does that lower inflation?
Well, lowering inflation, actually, that's the role of government overall.
Let's go back to my question. Are income tax cuts right now in the best interest of lowering inflation was my question.
I think you can have both. You can have the government peer
back. My question is it in the best interests of lowering inflation?
It is. We can have Kiwis who are working really hard have a few more dollars in their own back pockets for getting up and going to work every week to provide for their families, while as a whole government, we cut back on resourcing and we cut back on government spending because that has a huge inflationary effect. So you don't have to cut back everything. I take that, but you can have a balance. And we're rebalancing away from huge government spending and allowing more New Zealanders to have more of their own money.
Brooke Van Velden, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
If you want to contact the Q&A team, please kōrero mai. These are our main platforms. You can email us, you can find us on X or on Facebook. After the break, the leaky homes crisis cost New Zealand more than $10 billion. We ask how government can make it cheaper to build while avoiding the same mistakes. Welcome back. The government has announced new plans to massively expand the range of building products available in New Zealand by recognising building and product standards from overseas. Chris Pink is the new Minister for Building and Construction. Kia ora, good morning.
Good morning.
Congratulations on your appointment.
Thank you.
What do you want to achieve?
We need to achieve a rebuilding of the economy overall as government, and as a part of that, building and construction sector absolutely needs to be able to build much more simply, more cheaply and much more quickly.
Let's go to basics then. What is the purpose of having those standards in the first place?
The purpose of the standards is to ensure that we get good quality at the same time as we have, hopefully, timely and affordable outcomes. The standards are designed to ensure that, according to our building code, we don't have buildings that are, you know, not fit for purpose, given conditions and you know, basic physical reality of what people need, you know, Kiwis to live, work and play. So we've got standards at the moment. We've got New Zealand standards. But out there in the world, there's a whole heap of other jurisdictions that have got equal or higher standards that we can measure our own products against and also products of those overseas jurisdictions.
So how will these changes work? How will you decide which jurisdictions you will be essentially taking advice from?
Yeah, well, we've got a consultation process kicking off essentially now. So within the legislative side of things, we've got the Building Act Amendment that we're going to need to be able to make this happen. But then at the same time, and actually acknowledging a lot of work's already been taking place, talking with the industry and saying exactly what it might look like. So we want to look at jurisdictions that are quite comparable in terms of conditions, quite comparable in terms of their systems, and as I say, equal or higher standard in terms of performance under pressure.
Are there markets that are comparable in terms of conditions?
Yes, there are, absolutely.
Like what?
Well, I mean, a good starting point would be Australia.
So what's the seismic risk in Australia?
Yeah, seismic is lower, admittedly, but if you look at Vancouver, Canada, for example...
The sun in Vancouver?
Yeah, well, a lot of sun in Australia. So
There are different jurisdictions that are appropriate
absolutely.
For different...
And that's why we've been talking about credible and comparable jurisdictions. Now, it might be that there isn't one that's exactly the same as New Zealand. I mean, there's no parallel universe in which there's another New Zealand, but there are other countries with coast, there are other countries with heavy UV loading in the sun, so go back to Australia. For example, you've got Victoria and Tasmania, quite similar. So it might be that we take a nuanced approach and says Australia is good for everything except on the seismic side of things.
Right. Who will actually decide? Will that be you?
Well, it'll be, I mean, government
through the legislation. Yeah, right.
Yep.
So we will. There's a possibility we will end up with a situation whereby we say you can take these products from Australia, you can take these products from the EU, you can take these products from North America, depending yep. on the various conditions.
Sure.
Will there be any mechanism to stop jurisdiction or regulator shopping once these things are in place? And by that I mean being approached by industry who says, hey, look, this product's been approved in North America. Sure, it's not necessarily approved in Australia just yet, but we think it'll be all good.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are dominant market players everywhere around the world, and you know, it's a general problem or concern for government that we need to be mindful of the need to have standards that are rational and reasonable and able to be justified in technical terms. At the moment, the government already does this effectively through the code mark regime, whereby we say, at the moment, a building consent authority must take note as approved a product that's gone through that. Trouble is that and other pathways can take up to 2 years. So in a way, we're not actually doing anything different. We're just saying that actually where the certain boxes are ticked and we're confident on the quality side of things, we'll be able to do that much more quickly, and also with greater certainty will enable people to actually go ahead and do it.
What could go wrong?
Well, that's a very fair question. I think in this case, we're actually not going to have any products in New Zealand buildings other than those that theoretically could already be used here. Because, of course, you can already have overseas products. But the thing is, we'll be measuring against standards that are not yet in New Zealand, but if they're, again, equal or higher specifications, then we'll be able to use those. So
you're going to be forcing local governments and their consenting authorities to accept overseas products for consenting. What engagement have you had with local government to this point?
Yeah, I've been talking quite a lot with local government, and MB, of course, on the government agency side of things, has been actively involved in that conversation. And as I say, there's already these sort of mechanisms through Codemark, and you know, you've got the likes of Brands doing the building research piece. So in a way, we're not doing anything new. And what the system currently allows is, or requires actually, is these building consent authorities, councils, as you say, to take note as must be approved, you know, certain products.
Yeah.
So they don't have liability to the extent that they must take note of those. However, to your general question about risk and you know, avoiding leaky building saga, always the elephant in the room, they still have overall responsibility for checking the appropriateness of that product, you know, to be used in a certain way, that it's been installed correctly, and also the suitability of the building consent application
and
implementation overall.
Right, so there is still an element of liability that remains. Is that is the liability for councils any different to the current liability they face?
Well, only to the extent that we'll be putting more products on the table and saying these are good to go.
Right.
Don't look into those. And we'll say, well, that's fair, only, you know, fair enough to say that they didn't be liable for you know, not having to ask the question about those products.
Right. For companies that are looking to import new building materials into New Zealand, what requirements will you be putting on them to provide ongoing guarantees?
Well, I mean, we've got general consumer protection law in New Zealand, and obviously there are difficulties of enforcement across different jurisdictions, but of course in New Zealand, if you've got the Kiwi mum and dad classic building a new home or renovating, at the moment the footprint in New Zealand is still with the builder himself or herself and the importer of the product, so that will remain in place. And then under the Building Act as well, you've got those general implied guarantees or implied warranties, excuse me.
What if a product is approved by, say, Watermark, I think it is in Australia, but during a construction project using one of those products, Watermark removes its certification for that product?
Yeah, well, I mean, the same as if we have a product in New Zealand that's certified by our own code mark, and that were to be removed, it would be the same.
Except that it's in New Zealand, right? So if that's the case, if something's given certification overseas and then that certification is removed by that overseas jurisdiction during a construction project, what happens?
Well, actually, it's funny you should ask, because what we're doing as well is some work in the space of what we're called minor customisation or minor variations, whereby at the moment you've got this difficulty, and it played out during the JIB plasterboard crisis of a couple of years ago, whereby if you've got a building consent application that specifies particular products and for some reason they're not available, you know, it might be a domestic reason or it might be supply chain difficulties, again, refer COVID, and, you know, you don't have to follow the news too much to know that the Red Sea is difficult to get goods through at the moment. And at the moment, it's difficult to swap products in and out, but we're going to make that a lot easier as well for that flexibility in the situation you described.
What engagement have you had with insurers?
A bit. I've met recently, I think it was just last week, with the Insurance Council and individual particular insurers. They're going to be a major part, so are banks. Everyone's got to be interested in how we allocate risk. Of course, that's the name of the game for their business, but it's also government's businesses to be managing risk.
Is it reasonable to expect that some insurance premiums will increase for building projects that rely on international products?
I don't think so. But, of course, that's a matter of private contract between insurers and those who are doing the work. I think in terms of insurance in general, that's one of the places that we can look where risk properly applies. You've got the people doing the work, you've got the products, which is what we're talking about today. You've got the processes, so that's the Building Consent Authority reform that we've said that we're going to need to do. And the other P is private insurance. And the ability maybe to say where there's an opportunity to lean on that with a trusted provider doing the work, that we can actually take councils or Building Consent Authorities out of the picture a little bit, speeds things up, takes that joint and several liability off them as well.
How does Fletcher's feel about this?
Well, I've deliberately not been specific in terms of players in the New Zealand market at the moment.
We have mentioned the gym crisis once or twice in this interview already, though.
Well, that's a real thing, and the Commerce Commission did a study on that, and one of the outcomes of that was talking about more competition. It's exactly what we're doing, as well as more particularly speeding up those approval pathways.
So you haven't been specific, but what impact do you expect this legislation to have on an outfit like Fletcher's?
We expect greater competition, so good providers that are meeting the market in terms of New Zealand that are competitive as against overseas jurisdictions. You know, they'll still be well placed. And actually, of course, in New Zealand, we don't have the problem of the time and cost of shipping and the lack of resilience there sometimes. So it'll always be easier for Kiwi companies. Mm. And also the other bit is that Kiwi companies measuring against overseas standards for the purpose of building in New Zealand automatically have a ticket to make themselves more saleable in your Sydneys, your Melbournes, your Queenslands, and of course further afield too.
At what point, what do you mean more saleable?
Well, I mean, they've already met, for example, the Australian standard, the Canadian standard or whatever, so they can go to you know, the consumers in those other countries.
Right,
so
I see what you're
we're
saying.
We're already at your level.
Sure, sure. When do you expect we will be at a point where people looking to build new homes or new construction projects in New Zealand will actually be able to bring in these products?
Well, I'm hopeful...
When do we get to the finish line?
Well, I'm hopeful that the legislation will be passed by the end of the year, and that's a pretty standard process. We're not looking to go urgency or sort of truncate that process, but we do need to move at pace as part of the government's program for going for housing growth more generally and rebuilding the economy. But, of course, you know, that takes a bit of time. We want to get the detail right. And parallel with that legislative process, where people will be able to talk to the Select Committee about, you know, what exactly they think should be the case with this devil in the detail. At the same time, we'll be talking to industry, continuing to talk to industry, about what they think, you know, where those lines should be drawn.
You are also the Minister for Veterans Affairs. Do you think New Zealand treats its veterans well?
I think we could do much better. I think we've got a legal obligation and a moral obligation to help those who have served our country, men and women who have put their hand up to serve this country. They'll go anywhere, anytime, no questions asked, and I think we need to recognise that.
Yeah, so how could we do better?
Well, the most basic and fundamental question is answering the question, what is a veteran? At the moment, we've got a lot of ex-service personnel, including some who have been in uniform for decades, who aren't veterans.
Including you, right?
Well, you know, much, much more modest period of time.
Yeah.
In my time as well, a bit split with Australia, so there's, you know, complexity there.
Are you a veteran? Under the current
in New Zealand
distinction?
Terms, in New Zealand terms, no. As an Australian, yes.
Right.
But not as a New Zealander. And as I say, reasonably modest period of time
that
I was in our Navy. But, you know, the people who've been in for, you know, up to 52 years in one case, they're not veterans because the particular deployments they did weren't qualifying operational service, particular, you know, phrase and qualification under the Veterans Support Act.
One of your first moves in government has been to cancel the Veterans Independence Program for new clients, right? It's an in-home support service for veterans. I think it's, for many veterans, the only kind of real support they actually have. Why?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's a pausing of the program and, you know, upcoming budgets may allow more resource than has currently been appropriated. So we're going with what we've got currently. I've got to make decisions on what's in front of me. But the reason that the Chief of Defence Force made that call was actually because at the moment the mandatory obligation under the legislation is to provide or respond to claims by veterans who are injured or ill in the course of their service to the nation. Huge time frame blowouts, sometimes up to a couple of years. Average time, for example, disablement pension application, 361 days. We're not meeting that statutory requirement. That's the need to have, the relative nice to have of the Veterans Independent Program, your lawn mowing, your gutter clearing and so on. That's has to be less of a priority in legal terms, but we'll get that back as soon as we can.
If a former soldier or service person gets injured or experiences something like PTSD in the course of paid security work, should they still be able to access the support available to soldiers who haven't undertaken that kind of work?
Well, that's outside my remit as Veterans Minister, because by definition they're not veterans if they're not doing it for the New Zealand government, and I think that's probably...
But if they are also veterans... If they are veterans who then move on to private security work.
Yeah, well, certainly as at now, it's the case that it's about being injured or ill in the service of New Zealand as a serving member of New Zealand Defence Force, wearing that Kiwi on the heart and the sleeve. But, I mean, we've also, of course, got ACC and health systems more generally to provide service to Kiwis who need that.
As a former submariner, what do you think about the prospect of nuclear submarines in our part of the world?
I don't think there's any appetite to change anything in relation to nuclear weapons. Nuclear propulsion, obviously, is a different matter. And Australia's a sovereign nation. And I know that, you know, the Foreign Affairs and Defence Minister...
It's OK, I'm not going to get you in trouble. No, I just wonder, I know you're a bit of a submarine geek, right? So, I mean, what do you think about having that bit of kit relatively nearby?
Yeah, I mean, they're incredible machines and the strategic ability that they provide in terms of their reach, in terms of their endurance, the ability to remain undetected and be anywhere within the given radius within a region, for example, Asia-Pacific or Indo-Pacific, if you prefer, is incredible. So Australia, you know, it'll be interesting to watch how they go with that. That's a big step forward for them.
Would we know? Would we have the technology to know if a nuclear-powered high-spec submarine was in our territorial waters?
A submarine worth its salt will not be known to be there unless it wants you to know it's there.
Do you think people understand the nuclear propulsion versus nuclear weapons dimension properly?
Probably not. No.
How so?
Well, they've both got the word nuclear in them, so a lot of people sort of conflate those two things. And, of course, nuclear weapons we're rightly very nervous of as a global community, including in New Zealand, and acknowledging that historic leadership role that we've played in the global community. And, of course, with propulsion or energy in general, obviously that's, you know, not without question in itself. But these, you know, that by definition would be a Minister of Energy kind of question in terms of how we view that.
Thank you very much for your time. Chris Pink. Hey, so you know, as well as watching our show on TVNZ Plus, you can find all of our interviews on YouTube. Just search NZ Q&A and we will pop right up. After the break, when this was painted over, the police said they were investigating it as a hate crime, but there actually isn't any such thing in New Zealand, at least for now. When the new government took office, the Law Commission was told to immediately stop working on hate speech legislation. But the government is continuing work in considering hate crimes. Hate motivation can be an aggravating factor at sentencing, but as it stands, hate isn't its own specific category of crime. Fiona Owen explains.
Police are calling a paint attack on a central Auckland rainbow crossing a hate crime.
We don't have specific hate crime offences in New Zealand.
Wellington lawyer Graham Edgler.
When you're talking about hate crime, you're talking about things which are already illegal. You know, so assaulting someone is illegal. You know, burgling someone's house, vandalism is illegal. And so all those things are already crimes. So it's a question of in what way is it worse, or how do you define it to be worse because of the nature of the victim? Certain sorts of things would be easier to prosecute as hate crimes. You know, the difference between vandalism, throwing a brick through a window, which could have a hate element to it, versus vandalism, you know, painting a swastika on the side of a Jewish person's house.
But a hate crime law may be on the horizon. The Law Commission has been instructed to look at hate-motivated offences.
As a coalition agreement said, we've stopped them from carrying on with hate speech legislation reform because that's not something we're going to do, but we have asked them to continue their work on hate crimes.
So we actually thoroughly confused what he's actually wanting.
In a prayer room off Lambton Quay, Abdul Razak shares his astonishment that hate speech has been dropped. He heads the Royal Commission Committee for Local Islamic Organisations.
They're researching the possibility of bringing in hate crime legislation. You're supportive of the hate crime legislation?
Absolutely, but the two are so interlinked. And this clearly stated in the Royal Commission report that you need to look at the expression of hate as part of the hate crime legislation.
Following the Royal Commission report, hate speech reforms were proposed by former Justice Minister Chris Farfoy, watered down by the next Labor Justice Minister, Kerry Allen, and vigorously campaigned against by the coalition parties in the lead-up to the election.
Our simple belief is that in a free and open society, the best response to speech that you don't like is more speech rather than police prosecutions.
The Free Speech Union is claiming a chunk of the credit for the dumping of hate speech.
Without a doubt, we were the leaders in the space saying that hateful speech can be a problem, but censorship is not the answer.
Scotland's new hate crime laws were expected to meet a backlash. And here it was on day one.
Scotland's new law, which came into effect earlier this past week, will be keenly observed from here.
Scotland has changed it. It's been somewhat controversial. And I think their law appears to sort of both address hate crime as well as hate speech.
What we've seen in the UK generally, and specifically in Scotland, is this as an ideological rod to beat the backs of opinions that are out of favour at the moment.
It's all about the wording. If you get the wording wrong, you're going to have the same disaster that, you know, Scotland is now facing.
You think that's a disaster?
Of course it's a disaster. They didn't have that discussion. So now you have a situation like a very prominent person, J.K. Rowling, saying, hey, I can be accused of hate crime. If I believe in a two-gender approach, it's hate crime.
But that's all yet to be tested. Here, the Free Speech Union insists its work is not done. It now has concerns about our possible hate crime law.
What does hate crime mean? Defacing a rainbow crossing? Defacing Te Tiriti at Te Papa? Palestinian protesters throwing red paint on public officials' offices?
Do you consider those to be hate crimes?
All of them are crimes. What I consider a hate crime is different to what you consider a hate crime is different to what someone else considers a hate crime. Hate is a subjective term.
And what about the attack on the rainbow crossings? The Kay Road one, reported internationally.
Is that a hate crime?
I don't think it is, or at least not as New Zealand currently defines it in the sentencing.
Why is it?
For something to be treated as a hate motivating factor, increasing a sentence that might be applied, the person committing the offence must have done it because they perceived that the victim was a particular protected class, so a sexual minority, a race, or whatever. The victim in this case, as far as I can tell, is the Auckland City Council. The Auckland City Council isn't a protected minority.
Abdul Razak is still determined that the government should make faith a protected characteristic. Police report that last year, most hate incidents involving religion, 58%, were targeted at Muslims.
The vile statements which are made, in supermarkets against Shuhada ladies, you know, we have in Christchurch, who ended up crying. Imagine your father has been killed and then you're at a supermarket and some yobo comes along, go away your terrors, go back to your home country. How does that feel? Is that the type of society we're going to have? Don't we deserve some sort of safety net with these kind of legislation? I think we do.
And he intends to make that appeal to the Prime Minister. So now it's hate crime in the spotlight. It's expected to be at least a year before the Law Commission reports back to Parliament.
Fiona Owen with that report. Hey, our Q&A. Q&A is back after the break. Kia ora koutou. Hey, just before we go this morning, there has been some confusion this week over the future of the Suicide Prevention Office after the PSA union claimed the Ministry of Health was proposing to cut the office. The office was established back in 2019, but when we spoke with Mental Health Minister Matt Ducey on Q&A last month, he was critical of its performance.
At the moment, we've got the Suicide Prevention Office, and I must say it's a sensitive area, but actually, from the outside looking in, I've been quite disappointed with the Suicide Prevention Office. I think it hasn't had the leadership that it should have had. I don't think it's got the profile of actually directing what it needs to do.
This week, Matt Ducey said the closure of the Suicide Prevention Office had not been raised with him, and he was surprised by the union's statement about the Ministry of Health's proposals. It's his expectation the Suicide Prevention Office will remain open. Kua mutu. That is Q&A for this week from the Q&A team. Thank you for watching. Ngā mihi ki a koutou I ngā karere. Thanks for your feedback. Hei te rā wiki. We'll see you next Sunday at 9 a.m. Q&A is made with the support of New Zealand On Air.